Right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going deep on a case from, you know, back in 2007, but one that still has a lot of relevance, I think, especially for those of you out there, you know, maybe in law school or just starting out in M&A. It's the Louisiana Municipal Police Employees Retirement System v. Crawford case, but you've probably heard it referred to as the Caremark CVS merger case.
This one's a classic for sure. I mean, it's got it all, right? You know, you've got this big merger between these two huge companies, Caremark and CVS, and then you've got these, I guess you could say technical, but really important disclosure issues that almost blew the whole thing up. And I think, you know, what's really interesting is it's still cited all the time in M&A deals today.
Yeah, I mean, it had some pretty big numbers involved too, right? I mean, there was like a $675 million termination fee hanging over everything, and then on top of that, there was this special $6 dividend being offered to shareholders, and then to make things even crazier, Express Scripts jumps in with a competing bid. Like, it's a real nail biter if you're into corporate law.
Oh, for sure. It's like a textbook example of, you know, a high stakes M&A battle. But I think what's, you know, really important for us to get into today is why this case, why it's still so relevant today. So I guess our mission today is to really try to understand, you know, the legal principles that were either, you know, established or reinforced in this case, especially around, you know, what companies have to disclose, what shareholders' rights are, specifically what are called appraisal rights, and how courts look at these deal protection mechanisms, you know, things like termination fees that are used all the time in these kinds of mergers and acquisitions.
Exactly. And we're really going to try to break it down so that, you know, even if you're just starting to learn about this stuff, you can understand what a reasonable investor, someone you might be advising someday, what they would need to know and what they would need to think about when they're looking at a big merger like this. So I guess maybe the first thing to do is just sort of set the scene, right? Like, what was actually going on here? What were the events that led up to this whole legal battle?
Okay, so it all starts with, you know, Caremark and CVS, they're in talks about potentially, you know, merging together. And like a lot of these deals, they come to an agreement that includes some, you know, pretty standard deal protection measures. So, you know, you've probably heard of these if you're, you know, following M&A at all. There's what's called a force the vote provision, which, you know, kind of like it sounds, it forces Caremark to put the merger to a shareholder vote, even if a better offer comes along. There's also a no-shop provision, which means that Caremark can't really go out and look for other bids. And then, of course, there's that big, you know, $675 million termination fee that we talked about, which either side would have to pay if they backed out under certain
Right.
circumstances.
So they're trying to make sure this deal happens. But then, if I remember correctly, Express Scripts comes in and throws a wrench in the works. I mean, this is where things get really interesting, right? Especially if you're, you know, fascinated by how these deals work, the dynamics of it all.
So while all this is going on with CVS, you know, Express Scripts just pops up and makes this unsolicited bid to merge with Caremark. And obviously, this, you know, throws everything into chaos, right? Puts a lot of pressure on the Caremark board. It raises some, you know, really interesting questions about, you know, their fiduciary duties, what they owe to the shareholders when you've got these competing offers. You know, it's the kind of stuff that you'll definitely run into in your corporate law classes.
So what did they do? How did the Caremark board respond to this offer from Express Scripts? I mean, that couldn't have been an easy decision for them.
No, not at all. But, you know, ultimately they ended up rejecting it, saying it wasn't what their agreement with CVS called a superior proposal. And, you know, that decision itself and how they got there, that would become a big part of the legal battle later on. But it doesn't stop there. CVS then comes back and, you know, changes the merge agreement a bit, and they add in this special dividend for Caremark shareholders, initially $2 a share, but then it gets bumped up to $6 a share. And of course, this dividend was tied to the merger going through.
Ah, there's that $6 dividend again. I can see why that might raise some eyebrows for shareholders. And, you know, it was around this time that some of the shareholders, including the Louisiana Municipal Police Employees Retirement System, they start to get really concerned, right? And they end up taking legal action.
They file a lawsuit in Delaware Chancery Court, which is, you know, kind of the big leagues for corporate law. And they're basically trying to stop the whole CVS Caremark merger. Their argument was that the Caremark board hadn't done enough to tell shareholders everything they needed to know, what's called material information, and that the way the merger was structured was basically designed to keep shareholders from making a truly informed decision, especially about their right to seek what's called an appraisal. And this is really the heart of the case, you know, when we're talking about shareholder rights.
Okay, so let's break that down a little bit. You know, for those of us who aren't, you know, corporate law experts, we've mentioned fiduciary duties a few times. What did the judge, in this case, Chancellor Chandler, what did he actually say about what a board needs to tell shareholders in a situation like this? What kind of information are we talking about here?
So Chancellor Chandler, he laid out a really clear framework for, you know, what actually counts as material information when it comes to a merger. And he said it's not just about, you know, something that might immediately affect the share price. It also includes anything that a reasonable investor, you know, someone who's thinking about how to vote on the deal, anything they would want to know to make that decision. So, you know, it includes the financial details, of course, but also things like, you know, are there any conflicts of interest that the directors might have? So it's a pretty broad view, you know, broader than what you sometimes see, like in securities fraud cases, where they tend to focus more narrowly on, you know, how likely is something to happen and how much will it affect the stock price?
So it's not just about the money, it's also about the motivations.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why are the people recommending this deal? You know, what's in it for them? That's a really important distinction.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where, you know, one of the biggest issues in the case comes in, which is how much the investment bankers were going to get paid.
Yeah. And if I remember right, the problem wasn't just how much they were getting paid, but how their pay was structured. Like, a big chunk of their fee, something like 30%, I think, was only going to be paid if the merger actually got approved. And the court said that wasn't properly disclosed to the shareholders.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes you wonder, right? Like, does that create a bias?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the concern, right? I mean, if you're a banker and you know that you're only going to get this huge payday if the deal goes through, are you really going to be as objective as you should be? Are you maybe going to downplay some of the risks or not really explore other options? And the court basically said, yeah, you know, this kind of fee structure can really matter to shareholders, especially when they're relying on the banker's advice. So for you future lawyers out there, you know, understanding these kinds of details, how they're disclosed, it's really important.
Makes sense. You know, it's all about transparency, right?
Yeah.
Making sure shareholders know everything that's going on so they can make a good decision. Now, there was another big issue in this case, and that was that shareholders weren't told about their appraisal rights. So can you explain a little bit about what those are and why the court thought it was so important for shareholders to know about them?
Sure. So appraisal rights, they come from Section 262 of the Delaware General Corporation Law, and they basically give shareholders a way to, you know, if they're not happy with the terms of a merger, they can go to court and have a judge decide what their shares are really worth, and then they can get paid that amount in cash instead of, you know, whatever the merger agreement is offering. It's a pretty powerful tool, but it's not always easy to use, and shareholders have to weigh the costs, you know, of going to court against the potential benefit of getting more money for their shares.
So just to clarify, if the merger was just a straight stock-for-stock deal, then appraisal rights wouldn't really be relevant. Right?
Right. That's usually right. Yeah. But in this case, things were a little more complicated because of that $6 special dividend that we talked about. And the plaintiffs argued and the court agreed that this dividend was basically just cash consideration being paid by CVS, just dressed up differently. In fact, the court even said, and I'm quoting here, that the $6 dividend was fundamentally cash consideration paid on behalf of CVS. So, you know, it shows how the court is really looking at the substance of the deal, not just the way it's structured.
Right. They're looking beyond the surface. And because there was this cash element, the court said appraisal rights should have been disclosed to shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another important takeaway, right? Understanding what really counts as merger consideration.
Absolutely. And by not telling shareholders about their appraisal rights, the Caremark board was, you know, according to the court, keeping them from using a tool that could have protected them financially. So the court saw that as a really big problem.
Okay, so we've talked about the disclosures about the banker fees and appraisal rights. But what about those deal protection devices that we talked about earlier? You know, the no-shop, force the vote, and the termination fee.
Mm-hmm.
How did the court view those, especially with all these disclosure issues? I mean, are those things inherently bad?
Well, Delaware courts, they're generally okay with these kinds of deal protection devices as long as, you know, they're used appropriately. And they can make sense, right? They can help keep a deal on track and prevent other companies from, you know, just coming in and trying to grab a company at the last minute. But, and this is a big but, The shareholders have to know about them, and they have to understand what they mean. The court called them a triple threat, but didn't say they were bad in and of themselves, as long as the shareholders were properly informed about the deal and their rights.
So it's not that these devices are illegal or anything, but they have to be disclosed, right? And shareholders need to understand how they might affect things, especially in light of things like the contingent banker fees and their appraisal rights.
Right.
It's all connected.
Exactly. It all comes down to informed consent. The court wanted to make sure that shareholders had everything they needed to make a smart decision about the merger.
Now, one thing that I think is really interesting is that the court didn't actually block the merger altogether, even though they found all these problems with the disclosures. So why not? Why didn't they just say, nope, this deal can't happen?
That's because Delaware law really emphasizes what's called shareholder autonomy, which is the idea that, you know, at the end of the day, it's the shareholders who get to decide, as long as they have all the information. The court isn't there to second guess the board's decisions, you know, as long as they're acting in good faith and keeping the shareholders informed.
So they basically said, look, we're not going to tell you what to do, but you need to have all the facts before you make a decision.
Right. So instead of stopping the whole deal, the court issued what's called a limited injunction.
Okay, and what does that mean? What did that injunction actually do?
Basically, it said that Caremark had to postpone the shareholder vote until they made proper disclosures about the banker fees and the appraisal rights. So the idea was to give shareholders a chance to, you know, reevaluate the deal with all the information.
That's interesting, right? Like, it's a very specific, targeted remedy. They're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They're just saying, fix this problem, and then you can move forward. It's a good example of how courts can be really nuanced in these kinds of cases.
Absolutely. And preliminary injunctions, that's what this was, they're often used in corporate law disputes, you know, to try to address a specific harm without, you know, taking drastic measures like blocking a merger.
So big picture, you know, this case is from 2007. So how has it actually affected the way M&A deals are done today? Have we seen any real changes as a result of this decision?
Oh, definitely. You know, after Caremark v. CVS, there was definitely a lot more scrutiny on how investment banker fees were disclosed. And it became much more common to see really detailed breakdowns of how those fees were structured, including, you know, any contingent parts. I remember, you know, a few years after this case, I was reading a deal announcement, and I was just struck by how much detail there was about the banker's compensation. And it was clear to me that Caremark had had a big impact.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that was one of the big problems the court identified, right? So when you're reviewing these documents, you know, pay attention to those details.
Absolutely. And you also saw more attention being paid to what you could call appraisal avoidance techniques, you know, ways that companies might try to structure deals to avoid triggering appraisal rights without properly disclosing it.
So it's made things more transparent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's reinforced the importance of shareholders being aware of their rights.
Exactly. And I think it also underscores a broader point, which is that disclosure is about more than just checking boxes, you know, to comply with SEC rules. It's a core part of a board's duty to its shareholders. It's about giving them the information they need to make informed decisions. And this case really shows that courts are going to look not just at the financial terms of a deal, but also at the process and the information that was provided to shareholders.
So this is all really interesting stuff, but you know, why should someone who's listening to this today, why should they care about a case that's almost 20 years old? I mean, how is this relevant to their careers?
Because the principles in this case, you know, the duty to disclose, the importance of appraisal rights, how deal protection devices are used, these are fundamental to corporate law and finance, and they're still relevant today. I mean, every time a public company does a merger or acquisition, the lessons from Caremark v. CVS are there in the background, shaping how the deal is structured, how information is shared, and how courts are going to review it. So understanding this case, it's really foundational.
It's a perfect example of how a legal precedent can have a real impact on how business is done. Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive into a really important case. But before we go, here's a final thought to, you know, chew on. We talked about how the court in this case, they really stressed how important it is for shareholders to have all the information so they can make their own decisions. But what happens when that bumps up against, you know, a board that's convinced they've got a great deal, one that's really in the best interest of the shareholders? I mean, how do you balance those competing interests? And how does that get even more complicated when you start thinking about, you know, all the complex financial instruments and deal structures that are out there today? It's something to think about as you move forward in your legal studies. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.